Seattle is like a second home to me because intelligent design has one of its homes here in downtown at the Discovery Institute. Flying here from Chicago, where I live, often feels like coming to a very comfortable place, and I'm glad you're all here today. Intelligent design is widely misunderstood, not only by its atheistic critics, its critics within the scientific community or the culture at large, but also by many Christians. For instance, both of the major young earth creation organizations in the United States, ICR and Answers in Genesis, over the past few years have published critical remarks about intelligent design for various reasons. And so what I want to do today, is to try to give you a framework for understanding intelligent design so that some of these misunderstandings will be cleared up. And I hope that I finish quickly enough that we have time for questions and answers, because you probably will have additional questions. So the first thing I want to do is look at three myths about intelligent design. And we'll first look at them, and then I'll explain to you why they are myths. Now, the first one is a criticism that one often reads raised by the academic critics of intelligent design or critics within the scientific community, namely that intelligent design is just creationism light. Creationism for people who drink Chardonnay, creationism in a cheap tuxedo, and so forth. In particular, this view sees intelligent design as the repackaging of creationism to try to get around constitutional obstacles in public schools. So there's the first myth. The second one is that intelligent design is simply God of the gaps reasoning. In other words, the scientific community, let's say evolutionary biology, has some puzzle that they haven't solved, and the intelligent design advocate comes along and jams a designer into that open problem. Not adding anything to scientific knowledge, but simply saying, well, you've got an open problem there, like the origin of life, or the origin of the animals, or the origin of consciousness. Let's just push God in there. And this is seen as an illegitimate form of reasoning because there's no knowledge provided. Lastly, the last myth is that science does not need and cannot use the notion of intelligence to explain. That intelligence, this idea, is simply a placeholder for a more adequate physical explanation in terms of matter and energy. In terms of entities, that is, that are not minds. Now, I was struck in the preceding talk, and there was no prior collusion between us. Dr. Bile gave his presentation. I didn't know what he was going to say. How many of the themes he raised are going to be relevant to what I have to say? I was delighted to see that. So you've already seen discussion in his presentation of the notion of intelligence, where intelligence is something that cannot be reduced to matter and energy, that it has a real existence of its own, and that we typically refer to it by mind, by that term mind. And we distinguish that from matter and energy. Now, the model that I want you to keep in your minds as we go forward for the next hour or so is what I'm calling the dialectical model of human understanding. Within science, philosophy, and in fact theology, this figure here, this illustration, is a fragment of Raphael's famous School of Athens. And these two figures are right in the middle of that painting. If you've seen it, it's actually very, very large, filled with historical figures, but I want to focus on just these two. This is Raphael's depiction here of Plato on the left, and this is Aristotle, his student, his most famous student, on the right. Now, it's a bit difficult to see on this screen, but Aristotle is reaching out towards the ground. His hand is going down like this. Plato is pointing to the heavens. The view being that Plato had a philosophy that looked beyond matter, beyond the physical. Roger Penrose mentioned in the previous talk, while not a theist, at least not in the conventional sense, is a Platonist in terms of mathematics. He believes that mathematical objects are real, They're non-material, and they exist in a realm that is independent of matter and energy. Now, what you need to keep in mind in this picture is these two figures from the history of philosophy, and really from the history of science, are in a dialogue, they're in a discussion. And that mode of reasoning is very important for human beings. As you go out in your life, as you deal with people outside this church, let's say someone who just happened to read Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, you're sitting in a Starbucks, the natural mode of interaction between that person who is thinking about becoming an atheist and you is going to be a conversation. Think about the earliest description of Jesus in the Gospels, after the Nativity stories. What is it? Well, Jesus is in the temple. You remember the account. His parents have headed back to their home. They've gone a couple of days in their caravan. They expect that Jesus is with their friends. They can't find him. They have to go back to Jerusalem. Where do they find him? In the temple, sitting with the teachers. And what is he doing? He's in conversation with them. If you recall the scripture, he was asking them questions, listening to their answers, and then providing his own views on things. So the first description we have of Jesus, almost really in a sense the beginning of his earthly ministry, he's engaged in a conversation. So this adjective here, dialectic, has as its Greek root a word that refers to conversation. Now, why is this important? Well, here's the wrong way to think about intelligent design, and here's, in fact, the wrong way to think about how you should interact with other scientists, people in the culture who don't accept intelligent design or don't accept creation. This is the wrong way to think about it. Whatever they say, you're going to say the opposite, right? The famous gestalt figure of the face in the vase. So if Darwinian evolution is the vase, then intelligent design must be the face. It's just the logical contradiction of whatever it is that an evolutionary biologist will tell you. Now, that's easy to do because all you have to do is gainsay or contradict whatever your interlocutor brings up. So you're in that Starbucks talking to that person who's read Dawkins, and they say A and you say not A because they're going to be an atheist, or maybe they've become an atheist. That can't be right, so you're just going to contradict them. That's the wrong way to do it. And there's a reason why it's the wrong way. So let's say evolutionary biology tells us A, we're just going to contradict it. Or we say B and they just contradict us and so forth. That's an easy way to interact with someone, but it's the wrong way. Here's an illustration of why it's the wrong way. And I won't pick on us. I'll pick on an evolutionary biologist, a very famous one, Douglas Fatuma, who's written probably the most widely used textbook of evolutionary biology that you find at the college level. There's a picture of him, and a few years ago, he was thinking about intelligent design, in fact wrote a whole book challenging that view, and he looked at blind cavefish. This is a fish found in caves in Mexico, and if you look here where it should have an eye, it has a little tiny bit of an eye. But it's not a functional eye. These fish are, in fact, blind. And Fatuma asks, why would a designer do that? Why would a designer build a fish and then give it a little bit of an eye, but not a real eye, an eye that doesn't actually do anything? And in fact, within this genus, there are forms found outside the cave that are interfertile with these fish, so if you put them together, they can breed successfully. And those fish that live outside the cave have fully functional eyes. So his question is, why would a wise designer do that? It seems like a crazy way to build a fish. Now, let's take the same organism, the same species that is, and ask the question from an intelligent design perspective. These biologists, looking at the same data, said, you know what, those fish do have genuine vestiges. Once upon a time, their ancestors had eyes. They were isolated in a cave, total darkness, and in that environment, an eye is actually a bad thing to have. It's a site for injury. You swim into something, smack into your eye, comes a site for infection. You don't need the eye if you're able to feed and reproduce. You don't need to put energy into building that structure. So in that specialized dark environment, you can get rid of eyes. You can lose the information needed to build an eye. Now, what's interesting is these biologists, and I know this one very well, Wayne Frere, are both advocates of intelligent design. So using the exact same data, they come to a conclusion of intelligent design. And they say, in fact, in a design system, it's possible to lose information that you don't need if the environment is right. What's going on here? Well, what's going on is both of these scientists, they're both biologists, are trained in evolutionary biology, yet they are proponents of intelligent design. In fact, they're both creationists. And what they say is there are tools within evolutionary theory that are perfectly valid and sound that help us understand why this eye, or this lack of an eye, came to be. It doesn't show that the fish was not intelligently designed. What it shows is there's a history to this species, to this population. That history has events occurring in it that give rise to this structure, but the original progenitor of this fish was fully sighted. So they're using the tools of evolutionary theory to illuminate intelligent design. Now, let's step back to take a kind of philosophical perspective on this. And you heard this name. This is another wonderful convergence between the first talk and mine. Quine, great philosopher of science here, and Pierre Duhem, who was a French physicist and philosopher of science. And they point out that when we try to explain the world, we never just bring our theories as a single piece up against the world itself. What we actually bring to the world are complex bundles. Assumptions, we heard about those in the first talk, or presuppositions, some of which we may not even be conscious of. So a theory, instead of it being just kind of a single object, is actually a complex bundle. And when we bring that theory to the world to try to understand what we see, there may be assumptions that we've made that we don't know about, or that are so deeply buried we're not conscious of them, and those are creating problems for us. So testing of a theory is never a simple thing. So if we think about intelligent design and Darwinian evolution as these complex bundles, we can peel back the lid on those bundles and we can look and see what's inside. Gotta love PowerPoint. And you see in my little cartoon here that there are shared elements between those two theories. So for instance, I was just at a seminar last week at Southern Methodist University where four intelligent design advocates spoke. One of them, Rick Sternberg, presented a critique of theories of whale evolution using the tools of evolutionary theory itself, in particular the rules of population genetics. Those rules place a speed limit on how fast a new mutation can be incorporated into a population. Those rules are perfectly valid and sound. They're part of biological knowledge, yet they were discovered within the Darwinian framework. But because they're sound and well attested, in other words, you use them in understanding the world and they work, I'm going to want them in my bundle over here. So when we compare intelligent design to the Darwinian view, it's not going to be a case where there aren't shared elements. There will be shared elements between the two, between these two complex bundles. What that means then is we have to be very careful in discriminating the two positions, in separating them, because there's going to be a lot of shared content. So let's look now, with that philosophical preamble out of the way, at two definitions of intelligent design. Now, what you'll notice here in these definitions is there's no mention of God. Now, you might think, well, that's just more deviousness of intelligent design advocates. They want to get these ideas into public schools. They know they can't, at least in the United States, because of the First Amendment. So they're not going to talk about God. They're not going to talk about theology. That's actually a misunderstanding of the history of intelligent design, but actually, at a deeper level, it's a misunderstanding of the real content of the theory, as I'll show you in a moment. What these definitions say is that there are features of the world that are best explained by intelligence, where intelligence is a unique entity, unique in the sense that it cannot be dissolved into anything else. Now, if you think about your daily life, you function knowing that intelligence cannot be dissolved into anything else. Let me give you an example, a hypothetical, and this actually happened to me, unfortunately, earlier this year. Let's say you go to a movie with your spouse or a friend, and you come out after the movie to the parking lot, and you find, as you approach your car, that the driver's side window is broken, and there's glass everywhere. The window's been completely smashed out. You stick your head in through the opening, and you see that your Garmin, your GPS unit, is gone, and the cord, and the mount, and the digital camera that you had put in the glove box is also gone, but the tattered McDonald's bag is still there, and the road atlas for the Seattle area is still there. Now, what's the one inference you're not going to draw from that pattern? And it wouldn't matter if you were a Christian, agnostic, Buddhist, atheist, it wouldn't matter what else you believed about the world. The one inference you're not going to draw is that there was an unknown natural cause that can smash a window and get only the valuable objects out of the car. Now, this actually happened to me at the University of Chicago. I was attending a lecture, came back to my car, and the scenario that I described was there. The Garmin was gone, but all the junk was still there. So I got out my cell phone, dialed 911. That's what you would do. That's what any sane human being would do. Now, from certain patterns in the world, we refer them back to causes that are not physical. Let's say, in that original scenario I described, you actually see the guy. He's still in the parking lot. His Garmin, your Garmin, is sticking out of his coat pocket. He's not a very clever thief. You walk over to him, and you say, "That's my Garmin. I know the serial number of that unit. What are you doing?" And he says, "You know what? You can't really hold me responsible because I'm a physical system. You know, here I am. I'm a physical object. I didn't do it. The meat, the pile of meat, the 180, 200 pounds of meat that's here did it." You'll say, "Well, you know what, that might be true, but you had the power not to break into my car. A falling tree limb did not have the power to stop itself. You did. You, whatever your name is, are responsible because the causal story comes back to you as a unique agent. You possess a mind, and that mind can freely choose or not choose to do certain actions." This is how our criminal justice system works. This is how basic rationality works. So this notion of intelligence used in both of these definitions is not spooky at all. It's part of the toolkit of rationality that every human being has. Every time you open an email, every time you get a text on your phone, a certain pattern, you know at the other end of that pattern is a mind like yours. You're not conscious of making that inference, but in fact you do. So here's our toolkit of explanation, and it's something that everyone takes into the world, whatever their philosophical or religious views happen to be, and we discriminate between these two kinds of causes, where this one can bring about effects that these cannot. And I'll give some examples later on of how that ability to discriminate that human beings have between natural and intelligent causes is vital to the process of science itself. Well, our critic, our atheistic professor in Starbucks that we've been having this conversation with, says, "Oh, only devious intelligent design advocates make this distinction. What they're trying to do is get around the God problem." And he'll say, I'll make him a guy, "This is really what you're appealing to, supernatural causes, ghosts and goblins and spirits and God himself, things that we cannot observe. And therefore, because we cannot observe them, they do not belong in the natural sciences. And I don't care what clever stories you tell about people's cars being broken into, this does not belong in science. Because if we let it in, we have no way of controlling it. And we want science to be a coherent body of testable knowledge, and we don't want ghosts and goblins populating our theories." And our professor will go on, with his cup of coffee in his hand, "We can trace this change to Darwin and the Darwinian Revolution. Because prior to Darwin, as Professor Beil pointed out in his talk, when you look at Galileo, Kepler, Newton, the founders of the scientific revolution, God could be inferred from physical evidence, but in the Darwinian Revolution, God was shown to the door. politely but firmly shown to the door of science and sent on his way. In fact, that was the real sort of the heart, if you will, of the Darwinian Revolution. Not a theory about the origin of species, but at a deeper philosophical level, changing the rules of science itself, and our professor would say, and that's a good thing, too. And the rule can be captured in this short statement provided here by the National Academy of Sciences. The statements of science must invoke only natural things and processes. That verb is an imperative. That's what I say to my teenage daughters when they want to go out with their friends and they haven't done their homework or their room is untidy. You must do your homework. You must clean up your room. You do not have a choice. And to drive the point home, here is the logical modifier only that says, and that's it. You pop the lid on your toolbox of explanation, open it up, and look inside, and what you find are only natural things and processes. Now, this is a distinction that I think Christians in particular have to struggle with, because many Christians in the sciences support methodological naturalism, and they reject philosophical naturalism. In other words, they'd say, well, I'm not a philosophical naturalist, and you heard about that this morning, so earlier, I won't spend much time on it. In other words, they believe God is real, they believe the resurrection happened and so forth, but they would add, when I put on a lab coat or I put my eye to the lens of a microscope or in some way or another act as a scientist, I must assume that God is not interfering with what I'm doing, that the universe is a closed system of physical causes and effects. My own view is that this is a distinction without a difference, that if you're a methodological naturalist in terms of the science that you do, you might as well be one of these. And we can go into that in greater depth later. But I wanted to put that distinction on the table because I think it's an important one for us to be aware of. So there's our rule. Now, on that rule, really, this is how the universe breaks down. There's everything we understand and everything we don't. This might exist. An open-minded philosopher or scientist might say, well, you know, there could be a God. The resurrection might have happened. But if it did, or if God does not, or if God does exist, that can't be part of science. And they put their cut here. I want to show you very quickly that this is an unsound way of carving up the world of possible causes. Let's go back to the Gospel of John. Now, I have to apologize before I run this little thought experiment for you, because I once gave this at a Baptist college in the South. I won't say its name. And it went over like a lead balloon. I don't know the views of this audience in terms of the consumption of alcohol by Christians. So please extend me the philosophical, theological courtesy. My own view is that was real wine. It wasn't souped up grape juice. But I apologize in advance. I don't want to step on anybody's toes. All right. You're the steward in that story. And what you have in front of you is 30 gallons of really fine Merlot. In fact, if you read the account, Jesus made a lot more than 30 gallons. There was a lot of good wine there. But let's just focus on this vat. You haven't seen the backstory. All that you know is that someone has brought you a goblet with really good wine in it, and you don't know where it came from. Now, how did it come to be? If all you have is the wine itself, you don't know what might have brought it about. So all you've got is the effect. You've got the outcome. You don't know the causal path that led to the outcome. Are you going to be able to infer how that happened just from the effect itself? Well, we know two methods of making wine. Here's the one familiar to us. Which you've got to cycle through a lot to get something that you can actually drink. Yeah, you've got to cycle through that a few times before you get something that you can actually serve to people. This isn't mysterious. We do it. It happens all the time in Napa Valley, all over the world, in fact. It involves intelligence, though. Wine, drinkable wine, does not happen accidentally. In fact, wine, as an object, leaves a chemical signature on the inside of clay vessels that, when you find that, It's an ancient clay vessel. You can know that wine was kept in there. And that signature points back to intelligence. Here's the other method. And we don't understand that one. That's why we call it a miracle. Now remember, you're the steward and all you have is the effect. Are you going to be able to say, was it one or two? Was it method A or method B? What this suggests is that the natural versus supernatural distinction breaks down for events like this. In fact, it breaks down for things as simple as Yitzhak Perlman playing a Paganini concerto at breakneck speed. His fingers are moving so fast on the neck of that violin you can barely see them. 30-second notes. Brrr, like machine gun bullets coming out of that violin. You go back to his dressing room after the performance and you ask him, you know what, Yitzhak, how do you do that? How are you able to play that music so beautifully, so quickly, and so few people on earth can do that? And he says to you, I don't know, I just know that I can. The effect is real. We don't understand the causal process, but it clearly indicates intelligence. Or, take an athletic example. At the peak of his career, Michael Jordan could jump from the free throw line and dunk a basketball. It was Air Jordan. You've seen clips of him doing it. We go to the locker room. We ask him, how do you do that? Perform that incredible feat. He says, I don't know. I just know that I can. And now he can't anymore. It's not supernatural, because he's doing it right in front of us. He's a human being like we are, yet the outcome is something that points to a kind of special kind of cause, namely intelligence. In this case, where would we fit winemaking? It's not supernatural when we do it, yet the outcome points to intelligence. We need another category. We need intelligence. A special kind of cause that cannot be collapsed to natural causes. If all we have is the outcome, we can't say whether it was A or B. And what that suggests is that a better way to divide up the world of possible causes is not to contrast natural with supernatural, but to contrast natural with intelligent, where all types are included here, the ones we understand and the ones we don't. Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote the story 2001 and great science fiction novels that many of you have read, I'm sure, was not a Christian, not a theist. But he understood that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Meaning that at the limit, in terms of our ability to understand causes, we can converge to things that would look to someone else to be sheer magic. Imagine bringing back Aristotle and showing him a laser pointer. Or the TV remote that my daughters fight over, you know. They point at a box on the wall, and it changes the image instantaneously. And we ask Aristotle, explain this to us. As far as he knows, it's magic, yet we know it's not. The important point is the entities in question can only be explained by intelligence. Oh, the critic is unhappy. Takes a big sip of his coffee, and he says, you know what, it's just another attempt to evade the First Amendment. Only Christians worry about this. Well, that's actually not true. Now, because I'm running short of time, I'm not going to read this, but I will the last slide. I do not understand why the man who supposes that to have been possible, in other words, the previous slide says that physical causes could bring about these remarkable effects, shouldn't also imagine that 1 in 20 letters, now that should give you a clue to the author here, 1 in 20 letters in gold or any other material were thrown out on the ground. In other words, you've got a box with golden letters, 21 of them. You shake it, you throw it out on the ground, should not have spelled out the annals of Ennius, a miracle of chance, which I inclined to think would be impossible even in the case of a single verse. What's the image here? Well, imagine you've got something like Scrabble pieces in a box, and you shake the box, dump it out on the ground, and instead of a random assortment of letters, it actually spells the first line of the Declaration of Independence. That's what's being suggested in this metaphor. Now, does anyone recognize the author? Cicero. Notice the date. 45 years before anyone that we would call a Christian. This is his classic text on the nature of the gods. Cicero is describing a debate among Greek philosophers, pagans, not Christians, about whether the world was better explained by random physical forces or by intelligence. This debate between intelligence on the one hand and physical causes on the other does not belong to Christians. In fact, it extends deep into human antiquity. You can find it not only in Western cultures, but in Eastern cultures. A couple of years ago, I was here in Seattle working on a book, and I read a paper by three Hindu biologists looking at the human cardiovascular system. And their conclusion, and this is a scientific paper published in the peer-reviewed literature, was that that system that we all carry around in our chest pointed clearly to intelligence, not to Darwinian mechanisms. They're Hindus. I saw Deepak Chopra once on Larry King making a passionate case for intelligent design. And all of you know Deepak Chopra is not a Christian. It's a beautiful book written by a professor at Cambridge, published a couple of years ago, looking at this debate in antiquity among Greek philosophers. And he points out in the introduction that he's going to lay aside the whole contemporary creationism debate because it's simply not relevant. These Greek philosophers would have had no understanding of the debate in the terms that we do or that is laid out in the books here. Yet it was clearly a debate about intelligent design. So historically, this question in human understanding is not tied to any particular theology. What it arises from is really curious human beings looking at the world and saying, this living thing that I see, is it better explained by intelligence or by undirected physical causes? So the first myth is false. And if someone says that to you, remind them of Cicero and say, you know, Cicero was writing before Jesus was born. How could this be a Christian agenda? Let's look at the second point, and I have to move very briskly here to stay on schedule. Intelligent design is God of the gaps reasoning. Well, I want to focus on this term gap here with the following goal in mind. Not every question we put to nature will have an answer in the terms that we prefer. So many of the problems that modern evolutionary biology considers gaps may not really be there to be filled by knowledge. In other words, there's no gap that we can insert scientific discovery into. And the problem I want to focus on is something I talked about at SMU last week, and that is the origin of animal body plans. These are the major differences among the animals. The major architectural differences that even young children can recognize. So when my girls were quite young, toddlers really, like 4 and 5 years old, a little bit past the toddler stage, we went to tidal pools near Laguna Beach in California at low tide, and we would go out and walk among the tidal pools, and they were filled with living things like arthropods and echinoderms. And my older daughter, who wants to be a marine biologist now, a student at Brown University, was able to distinguish this kind of creature from this kind of creature because they just don't have the same overall form. Now, where did those differences come from? How did they arise? Many evolutionary biologists, even at the height of neo-Darwinian theory in the 1960s, when it was the dominant theory in evolution, were unhappy with the theory because they recognized it didn't really explain where these differences came from. So Conrad Waddington, for instance, who was an embryologist and a geneticist, worked on evolution. At a famous meeting in Philadelphia in 1966, said, the real guts of evolution, which is how do we come to have horses and tigers and things, that is the thing that we really want evolution to explain, is outside the mathematical theory. By that he means the theory that you would find in a textbook, where the rules of population genetics are said to govern what's possible and how evolution occurs. And he says that problem of building horses and tigers and things is not solved by theory. And this unhappiness has now become a dominant theme in evolutionary biology. It's not something you would see on a PBS program or read about in the newspaper, but if you go, as I do, to evolutionary biology meetings or read the primary research journals, you'll find statements like this. I've actually debated this professor, Massimo Piliucci. He has training both in evolutionary biology and the philosophy of science. And at a meeting a few years ago at Indiana University, he said the modern synthesis, that's textbook evolutionary theory, doesn't cut it. It doesn't work because it does not tell us how qualitatively new traits arise. And what we see with those body plans, their historical origin, is the appearance of qualitatively new traits. Things like legs and eyes and guts and sense organs of all types, antennae and so forth. It's not explained by textbook theory. Wallace Arthur is a geneticist from the UK, whom I met in the late 1980s when he came to the University of Chicago to do a sabbatical. And in this publication, he was beginning to show his real unhappiness with evolutionary theory in the textbook form. He's much more outspoken now. But he said, look, we really don't know how body plans originate. This is the Linnaean binomial for the famous peppered moth of England that many of you studied in high school biology. That kind of example, putative example of evolution, is actually only illustrating microevolution, and the origin of body plans is left unexplained. More recently, he put it this way, and I'll summarize this slide to stay on time. Evolution tells us, in terms of natural selection, you can have the differential destruction of genes. Some people in this room have left more copies of their genes in terms of number of children they have than others. In terms of natural selection, you are more evolutionarily successful than other people in the room. He says, if that's all that evolution amounts to, it's not really explaining where living things came from. He says, what we really need is some creation science. Meaning, we need a theory that explains how living things came to be, not how they differ slightly in terms of their features. We need that as a component of evolutionary theory, and it's not there now. And the reason that it isn't is because of how animals are built. Now, this is probably more biology than you expected to hear from me, but I'll try to lay it out in an accessible form. Here's a fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, a species about which biology has learned a tremendous amount in the past 100 years. These are sea squirts, tunicates. Both of them are animals, and they are built by a process of development from a fertilized egg. That process of development is cell differentiation and division. In other words, here's our starting point, a single cell that's fertilized, and it divides, and its progeny divide, and so forth. And gradually what we do, or what we see, in the developmental process is the construction of the adult. Now, if you think about the logic of the system, if you want to change the overall form of these creatures, modify their body plans to get something new, you have to start here at the beginning, because it's here that the body plan is put in place. And what you're going to use, if you're a Darwinian, is the process of natural selection, which has three fundamental requirements. You have to have variation, it has to make a difference to the number of offspring you have, and that variation has to be heritable. You can think about these like three legs of a stool, jointly necessary and sufficient for the process of natural selection to occur, and you need all of them. The main problem for evolution in building body plans is here, because the kinds of variations that you need don't occur. When they do, the organism is in trouble. No parent in an obstetrics ward, sitting in the waiting room, waiting for the news from the doctor about the delivery of a child, no parent wants to hear, as that doctor comes in, Mr. Nelson, your child has a macro mutation. Because in our experience, those kinds of changes are overwhelmingly destructive to the organism in which they arise. So the kinds of mutations that evolution needs to change body plan formation are those least likely to be tolerated by the organism. What that means is the very last thing that a fruit fly wants to do, or a sea squirt, is evolve in a way that macroevolution requires. Because those mutations are going to have to be expressed here, early in development. That's where the body plan is first put into place, and they have cascading effects that go through the whole process and either destroy the organism, it dies before it reaches adulthood, or leave it gravely unfit. They cripple it. This puzzle, this problem, has been known for many decades in evolutionary biology, and it's unsolved. This is not a mystery. I mean, this is not a secret. When I was a student studying evolutionary biology at the University of Pittsburgh as an undergraduate, I read a paper by John McDonald, who's a geneticist at Georgia Tech, and he says this is a great Darwinian paradox. We don't understand how macroevolution can occur because the kinds of variation we see are not the ones we need for macroevolution. And the ones we need for macroevolution are not tolerated by organisms. It's just not going to happen. Well, what sort of a cause can build a fruit fly for you, can aim at a distant functional target, can reuse genetic modules in different ways, can establish discontinuities between one kind of living thing and another kind of living thing? What kind of cause can do that? Before we answer that question, let me show you a really dramatic example of this problem, one that is actually going to be featured in a new film coming out next year from Illustra Media. Keep in mind that in the process of evolution, so here's our developmental pathway for this species, and it adds a couple stages, adds a couple more stages as evolution is proceeding. You can't do this. You can't be temporarily dead. You can't jump over a gap in the process and say, well, you know, I'm going to be dead for the next couple of hours, and then we'll continue the evolutionary pathway after that. So if we want to change A into something like B, so that's what's happening here, is these developmental pathways are changing. We want to macro-evolve A into something like B. You can't do that. Here's a way to think about the problem. This is a picture of Houdini there being lowered into a water box. This box is full of water. And his feet are attached to the lid there. They're going to lower him down and lock him in. What's the one thing he won't let himself do going into that box? Or what's the one thing he absolutely needs as he goes into that box? A plan to get out. Probably one plan to get out and a backup plan if the first plan doesn't work. You know, there's a clip, I've seen actually a couple of these on the web, awful grisly footage of an amateur magician who was buried in a box in sand, and he didn't have a plan to get out, and he ended up dying. So Houdini's going down into the water. He knows how he's going to get out of there. He's got a plan to get out. Well, the same problem exists for evolution. If you're going to go into a stage where you are unable to feed, where you're turned into goo, where you're profoundly disabled, you'd better have a plan to get out of that stage if you intend to successfully evolve. Well, we have a natural example of that. Here is a beautiful female monarch. The males have little dark spots here on either side that contain little scent glands. We had a very good year for monarchs in northern Illinois where I live. They were flying all over the place, so I saw a lot of these this summer. And right now, on the other side of the Rockies in the eastern United States, they're migrating to Mexico. It's absolutely unbelievable. Going thousands of miles to a place they've never been, never seen, using inbuilt onboard GPS of their own special design. Here's the monarch life cycle, probably familiar to you from grade school biology. Mom lays the egg, which turns into the caterpillar, which eventually turns into the pupa, and out comes mom, and the cycle repeats itself. And dad, too, of course, this is a sexual species. Now, let's think about this stage. There's the egg, and you can see these on the underside of milkweed plants if you look for them. They're beautiful little structures that kind of look almost like a little spaceship or a little tiny cathedral. Just gorgeous. When you look at a scanning electron micrograph, this exquisite detail is breathtaking. Well, we'll jump through the caterpillar stage, which is mostly just eating and eating and eating and eating. They increase their body weight like 3,000 times. It's amazing how fast they grow. To the fifth instar, when the chrysalis is being formed. So if you watch this happen, caterpillar hangs upside down and it swings in this J shape around in a circle to make sure it's not touching anything. because as the chrysalis is being formed, the surface before it hardens is very soft, and if it's touching anything, it'll create a problem. So it goes through its final molt, forms that. This is the mystery stage. The really amazing mystery stage. You know, the name chrysalis comes from these little golden dots that are on the surface here of the pupa. The Greek root of the term refers to gold. No one knows what they do. In any case, it's hanging here for 7 to 10 days. What's going on inside that chrysalis? Well, the first thing that's happening is massive cell death. There are processes that are digesting most but not all of the tissues from the caterpillar stage, turning them into what looks on sort of to the naked eye to be goo. So if you were to dissect a chrysalis, let's say at day one, open it up, what would pour out onto the coverslip looks like jello, or actually softer than jello. In fact, there's a great deal of structure there, but it's not visible to the naked eye. So the caterpillar is being chewed up by controlled processes of cell death, and you can be sure they're carefully regulated. These are powerful enzymes that are literally digesting the caterpillar tissues. And then that's being rebuilt into the structures of the adult. And it's a 7 to 10 day period. Now, how is natural selection going to get you in there and out again? This is, by the way, what happens at the very end. The surface of the pupa begins to darken, and you can start to make out the structures of the adult butterfly under the surface. Then the pupa fractures along a fracture plane. The adult comes out, hangs on, pumps up its wings, puts its proboscis together, which is really amazing because it's like having two halves of a straw. And it unrolls them, and they join at the center by a kind of Velcro attachment. And it needs to do that to be able to feed. Half a straw is not a straw. So it unrolls its proboscis, allows those two sides to knit together. As the wings harden, then eventually it can fly away. Now, let's go back to Houdini. Houdini's not going to go into that box unless he knows how to get out. The same problem exists for the monarch. At this point, it's effectively dead in terms of being able to make a living for itself. It's rebuilding itself from goo. How did natural selection evolve into that stage unless it also knew, if I can personify natural selection, how to get out the other side? Because it would have to go through this point. That can't happen by natural selection. It can only happen by a process that sees the way to get out at the same time. And that, in our experience, can only be done by one kind of cause. I'll skip these, because I've already explained. How do organisms solve the problem? They have parents. They have parents who provide everything needed here to get all the way through this cycle. So if you want any part of this cycle, any part of it, you need the whole thing at the same time. Not just the egg, not just the caterpillar, not just the pupa, not just the adult. You need the whole cycle to have any part of it at all. One kind of cause in our experience can bring about that kind of effect. Now, this problem is well known in evolutionary theory. Last year, a paper was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy by Donald Williamson, who's a zoologist in the UK. And I'll summarize what he's saying here. He's saying it's not possible for this to have happened by Darwinian mechanisms because the number of steps involved are too great. So his solution is to take a group like an onychophorin, a velvet worm that kind of looks like a caterpillar, doesn't it, and hybridize it with something like a grasshopper. Grasshoppers don't have a stage like a pupa. When you see a baby grasshopper, it looks like a little grasshopper, and they have what's called direct development. And somehow that made a viable hybrid. Now, this would be like you hybridizing with a clam. It's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. But this was published as a serious explanation for how that butterfly life cycle arose. This paper was so controversial when it was published that the National Academy actually changed the way they accept papers. You cannot publish a paper like this anymore. And if you go online and read about the controversy, this paper was really created a firestorm because it was saying the Darwinian mechanism has failed, and to explain what we see with monarchs, we need this kind of hypothesis. I actually admire him, not for the hypothesis, but for his courage. I think the hypothesis is dead from the start. What I admire is his courage in saying the current theory is so bad, we've got to try something radical like this. Let's go back to our question. What can do that? That's what can do it. And everything I've shown you, I would show to a professional biological audience. And why wouldn't they allow this as an inference? It has nothing to do with the evidence that we've looked at, because the evidence that we've looked at points clearly to the need for a cause that can see a distant endpoint and bring together everything needed to reach that endpoint. That's what the evidence indicates. And this, uniquely in our experience, is the only kind of a cause that can do that. The take-home message here is that intelligent design is not excluded from science for evidential reasons. It's excluded from science for philosophical reasons. And this was the point of Dr. Biles' presentation this morning, or one of the points anyway. Well, we're almost done. I'll try to move very quickly to the end. My philosophical friend there in the Starbucks with his cup of coffee says, I'm sorry, it's just more God of the Gaps reasoning. Well, here's what I would say to him, and here's what I would encourage you to say to any person who raises this objection. Not every question we ask, Not every question we ask is going to be answered in the terms that we prefer. He wants to explain the world strictly in terms of bottom-up physical causes where no mind is involved. And I would point out to him that you can put questions to nature and they may not have answers in the terms that you want. So let's suppose it's 50 years from now, I'm still alive, very elderly, but doing well. I like that outcome for myself. And I have a nephew who's working in a big lab on Mars. I'm bored. I've got a lot of time on my hands. I want to chat with him. All right, so I pick up my equivalent of a cell phone 50 years from now. No doubt it will be very high-tech indeed. And I have an unsolved science problem. I want to have a conversation with him in real time. In other words, I punch in his number in his lab there on Mars, and I want to chat with him just the way that we could talk right now in real time, where I say something, you say something, and there's conversation back and forth. That's my problem. How can Earth dwellers communicate in real time with Mars dwellers? That's my research problem. I can put that question to nature. Who knows the answer? You can ask the question, but you're not going to get an answer in the terms that you prefer or that I prefer. Why not? Well, when it's at its closest, Mars is about 35 million miles away from us in the fall, right about now, in fact. There's a speed limit on the propagation of signals through space. There it is. It's about 186,000 miles per second. Well, you just do the math. At best, it will be a six-minute round trip. So I put in his number, say, hey, Ian, how's it going? And then I can go and make myself a cup of coffee. And a little over 6 minutes later, he says, hey, Uncle Paul, how's it going? Now, because I can ask the question does not mean I'm going to get the answer in the terms that I prefer. Nature doesn't work that way. Well, the same problem exists for evolutionary theory. Maybe its unsolved problems are unsolved, not because we haven't tried hard enough, but because the questions we're putting to nature are not going to be answered in the way that we like. And the problem is we're not listening to what nature is telling us. We're not listening to her talk back to us. You can keep putting the same question to nature, and she'll reply and reply and reply, and unless you listen to what she's telling you, you're never going to make any progress. So these problems, these gaps, how did body plans arise? How did life come to be? Where does consciousness come from? That science wants to explain by strictly natural causes may be gaps that exist not in nature that we can fill with knowledge, but in our minds, because we have a fundamentally incorrect view of how nature functions. Well, I've run out of time, but I want to give you my last case study. Again, imagine you're talking to this atheistic friend, and he says, I can't use intelligence to explain. It doesn't get me anywhere. Remind him that science itself depends on our ability to detect the action of intelligence. So here's a famous case that involved fraud, science fraud at Bell Labs, and in fact embroiled the scientific community, including leading journals like Nature and Science, the two most prestigious science journals in the world. Hendrik Schoen was a young physicist at Bell Labs who was on his way to a Nobel Prize in physics. He had a string of experimental results that were really astonishing. The problem is no one could replicate them. There he is, smiling. And this is an article from the New York Times that shows that the university which granted him his PhD in Germany actually tried to take it away because the crime that he committed against science was so grave that they were really embarrassed, and they said, you're not entitled to a PhD. Now, no one could replicate these amazing results that he had generated, and people were starting to wonder, you know, what's wrong here? So Bell Labs formed an investigative committee to look at his publications, and as soon as they began to compare one paper to another, they discovered something very strange, which the title here indicates. Similar graphs raise suspicions. So here's a figure from the New York Times. I hope you can see it where you're sitting. Here is a figure from one of Schoen's papers from November 2000, published in Science, describing or purporting to describe an experiment on a light-emitting transistor. Here's another figure from another paper published in the journal Applied Physics Letters from December of the same year, looking at a different kind of transistor. Notice how similar these two diagrams are. Some of the curves are not present in one. Let's see which one. Yeah, this one is missing this curve right here. But what the investigative committee noticed was these regions right here, which the New York Times has blown up. They've taken this little section of that curve and they've blown them up here. You can superimpose these two lines right on top of each other. They're congruent. Imagine if I asked you to sign your name. I didn't tell you why. I said, sign your name for me 10 times on a sheet of paper. And most adults have a signature that is remarkably congruent from one occurrence to the next. In fact, banks and other government institutions or banks and government institutions use your signature as an identifier of you. When the investigative committee saw that these two lines match, Schoen's career as a physicist was over. And if you go online and read the story of why, in fact, you can download the whole report from the investigative committee. They said, that kind of match cannot happen because that's noise. That is something created by the instruments interacting with the physical system in question. There's a probability associated with that line that's very, very, very small. If you see the same line in another experiment using different materials, different setup and everything, the only way that that could happen is if someone meant for it to happen using his mind. There's no natural cause to explain that match. That match exists because Hendrik Schoen was faking his results by deliberate intent. So we've got a puzzle here. We've got this match, and we have to explain it. Now, an atheist looking at that pattern will exclude one explanation: natural causes. And it doesn't matter what else that atheist believes about the world. This pattern exists in the world because a mind, which is not reducible to physical causes, brought it about. And it doesn't matter what Hendrik Schoen says in his own defense. Oh, I'm a physical system. No, you're more than a physical system. Part of you is a mind which intended to have a successful career by cheating. You brought about this effect. It's not real in terms of a physical cause. It is real in terms of your mental intention. You have to retract your publications. Your PhD is going to be withdrawn. You're out of Bell Labs. The very process of science itself depends on our ability to detect this kind of pattern, because that's how we catch cheaters. So the reality of intelligence as a cause will not go away. unless you want to embrace irrationality. Help your friend, my hypothetical person sitting there in Starbucks, to see that there's nothing spooky about using intelligent design to explain. Every human being does it. We do it every day. It's part of the toolkit of human rationality. And if you give it up, you're giving up something that God gave you to understand the world. Well, I've run over considerably. I apologize for that. I actually have more material, but we need to stay on schedule. Thank you for being so attentive.